I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today. 750 is an easy platform for discovering everything you need to find as a wholesale buyer of wine and spirits. The searches are easy to do, and they provide a wealth of information for you to determine exactly what you need to buy today. Pricing, size, characteristics, who the distributor is, the contact information, and even helpful features like easy startup of credit apps are all available for you, as well as a listing of tastings, which is something I refer to almost all the time to find out about the tastings in my neighborhood. I personally use the 750 service. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's extraordinarily helpful if you are a buyer of wine and spirits at the wholesale level. And I recommend that you waste no time in making it a part of your daily routine. 750.com, the 750 service, make it work for you. Shelley Lindgren on the show of A16 in San Francisco, as well as SPQR and A16 Rockridge in Oakland. Hello, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me here.
Nice to see you.
It's great to be here.
So in the 90s, you started working at Fleur de Riz restaurant.
Yes, in the early 90s. I worked there for almost 7 years.
What was that like? You were with Maurice Rojas?
Yes. He passed away a couple of years ago. And Hubert Keller, who they just closed the doors in the end of June this past year, 2014. It was about a 40-year run. It's pretty good, restaurant lifespan. So it was, I felt like I was part of a family. I was the whole time I was at USF. I would work there 5 nights a week, and I was a captain, and I got to, do formal wine service. And basically, my background mainly is French wine, which if you met me today and knew how passionate I am about Italian wine and been focused for the past decade and a half or so, you would not know this about me. But yeah, it all starts in France, especially in American sommelier standards.
There was kind of a classical French canon that you were a part of and you learned the service standards of.
Yes, and I worked for Roland Passot for a few years before that, who still has La Folie restaurant and is an amazing chef, and also Julian Serrano, who I worked with him in San Francisco before he moved to Las Vegas and opened Picasso.
Really talented guy, I think.
I was so lucky to have those three mentors, and then I ended up going to cooking school and, always loved the integrating the food and the wine, because I would say if I picked one thing, like service is something that I'm absolutely crazy about and it's part of my DNA.
I think so.
It's, I'm the fourth of five kids and no one else in our family's in the restaurant business, but I just always really loved it. Love people and, nurturing and feeding. It's all about food and wine. So I think, I just embrace the Italian lifestyle naturally.
I mean, of all the people I've met in the service industry, I think you're one of the most naturally welcoming.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, easily, from my perspective.
Well, you make it easy, Levy.
Yeah, right. But why restaurants, though? I mean, what was going on?
Well, it was funny. I was talking to my brother the other day, and he said, Shelley, I remember you bought like all my clothes in high school. And it's, we grew up in West Marin, and we had a really nice upbringing and things, but we just, my mom, it was a single mom family, and she had a lot going on. So we were just very independent from a young age. And so I started working really young and loved that. I love to work. And I feel really fortunate that even though I was working and earning, if you look back now, it's like it wasn't that much. Babysitting, restaurants, dishwashing, hostessing, serving, and now, I think in all your decisions in life, whatever you're doing, it all comes together at one point, and you can't really just jump to the head of the line. You have to really pay your dues, and I started young, so I was pretty young when we opened A16. I'd already been working in restaurants for a long time, and my husband had two bars at that time, and he designed and built the restaurants, and without this group of community, supporting that had known me, growing up in restaurants and a husband and great business partners, it'd be really hard to have opened that today. I couldn't just have gone and done it on my own. So it was really a group effort.
So that restaurant opened in 99, but in between Fleur de Lis and that opening, you were at Bacar.
I was at Bakar. Well, actually, well, A16 opened in 2004, but Rome, 15 Romolo, Greg's first bar, opened in 1998. At Rosewood in 2000, Bakar, I was there after cooking school. I went to cooking school in 2000, 2001, and then I was at Bakar as a sommelier, and then opened A16.
What was it like working with Debbie Zacharias?
Oh, she's larger than life and amazing. And it was hilarious because I had Italian wine was my thing then too. And it was really a wonderful Austrian list and Burgundy and California, of course. And Champagne. We had some really great producers that I got to know intimately from working with that list. But it was like a three-story wine wall. And my little Italian corner was up in the men's bathroom on the third floor. So whenever I had to go get a bottle, I'd have to wait if there was a line and I had to go open the door to the wine wall in the men's bathroom, get my wine and run down. And it was so much fun. I was so young and quick back then. I was like, I love that because I had sold a bottle of Barolo or Brunello or something. So
what was the first introduction to Italian wine coming from some French background?
Well, studying with the quartermaster sommeliers for a long time. In fact, I was talking about this at the Women in Wine Symposium. It's a little bit today where there wasn't a lot of sommeliers back when I was started studying. So just for the first level, I remember studying for about 4 years thinking, okay, I think I can do this. I think I can, I'm really going to practice. And I was really diligent about studying. And then I took my exam and I remember sitting in Hubert's office and saying, I just want to let you know, I had to put Fleur-de-Lis down. It's where I work. And I'm taking the sommelier exam this weekend. And it hadn't really been done at Fleur-de-Lis at that time. And so when I passed, I had mainly a French co-workers. And not only, so it was like one of the couple of women that worked there and had taken the sommelier exam. And they were, it was a game changer, you know, because I had met a lot of friends in our community that were starting to take the exams. And I learned through those studies that, Italy has tons of grapes. And I'm a native California. So Italy has tons of grapes. And there's all these beautiful regions and great history. And that was my major. I love literature and I love history. And that's part of the romance with wine and talking about it with tables. And I just became really fascinated with places like Tarassi has a wine, or Sardinia, the people of Sardinia, then how far back they go to, I think, I want to say like Paleolithic times. And, you know, just so interesting, has a study of the progress of grapes and, you know, moving west. And so that was the first place I went to in Italy, was Sardinia.
What was that trip like?
It was a honeymoon. And we started in Paris because I was working at Fleur-de-Lis at the time. We started in Paris, rented a car, went to Alsace where Hubert is from, went to his family's patisserie. Hubert and Chantal were down in Cannes where he used to work. And we stayed with them one night. And I told them, hey, we're going to Italy tomorrow. You know, we'd already been gone for like 2 weeks. And he had never been to Italy at that moment. But literally, we're on the Riviera. The Riviera extends over to Italy. And it was about an hour away. And we just went all the way down to Livorno, put a car on a ferry to Sardinia, and woke up, and it was off season, so it was pretty empty compared to summers where it's packed and quite the spot. If you can get a plane over from mainland Italy, it's beaches and, you know, beautiful food and cheeses and great wines, and, you know, the wines were already great, and they're even better now than they were back then, so.
I find it's kind of an isolated place that has a lot of feel of a different culture. Like, it feels totally different than Rome.
You know? Oh, completely. It's like this kind of oblong island, and it is really far away. It's out in the middle of, you feel like you're on the west coast wines of Sardinia, places like Contini near Cabras, where they have that great Botarga, and Alghero, that Spanish colonial town, and there's all these special like horse training places, but you feel like it extends right to the Atlantic. You really feel your way out there. And then to the north, you have the cork trees, and it's completely different. And the southeast is much warmer, and you really feel it in the wines too. So
when did you decide, you know what, I think I'd like to open my own restaurant?
Actually, I got back from that trip, and I felt, once I went to Italy, it was like, I get it. click. Okay. Things are so they're simple, but thought out. And why is everything so delicious and wonderful? And we don't have that translation where we live when we have the ingredients. And so it went, I was kind of going between a breakfast place or pizza and wine. And I didn't really know what Neapolitan pizza was until I met my business partner. And so we were kind of playing with a couple ideas, and we looked at it, Greg and I looked at a few spaces, and I met my business partner and I said, we're opening a pizza place, and it's going to be, she's like, there's really no pizza of Naples here. And so next thing you know, we're going to Naples and eating pizza and meeting sommeliers and going to wineries and found that they were delicious and just kept doing research. And at first our list at A16 was going to be all Italian, and I was really trying to get California Italian. And now there's some really great producers doing interesting things, but it was really, really tough to really give that justice, because you have one Sangiovese tasting like it does in Italy, and then you had another Sangiovese that's this valiant effort, not quite there, but now you can really, there's a few people doing it, but doing really nice wines. But so it was really after that first trip coming back and then realizing these wines go with our food. There's lots of them. You have to go out and find them, but they're practically giving them away to me when we open, and our list was ridiculously inexpensive because something that's probably, four or five times the price now, it was maybe an older vintage, or just, it wasn't in the necessarily right state. But there's a couple of producers like Clelia Romano. Without her Fiano, it would have been hard to really say, I can hang my hat, we can focus on the South. And there was, a lot of families like Master Bernardino, Lebrandi, or Arnaldo Capri from Umbria, Planetas, people like wineries like that, that really, even 10 years ago, without them, there wouldn't be as much recognition. And now it's completely ballooned into the microcosms of Etna and, these different climates and styles of making wine, and completely beautiful and age worthy. And you wouldn't have thought that would happen 10 years ago.
So really a different world even a decade ago for Italian wine in this country, where most of the focus was either on Tuscany or further north, and you were looking a little bit further south, and there weren't a lot of sommeliers working with that wine, if any. And it was a matter of not having a lot of reference books and sussing out through tasting who the superstars were that you could really base a list on.
Exactly. It was just really trying to figure it out on my own, and not really knowing if it had been done in other places. It was just kind of an exciting thing. And I was there opening and closing the restaurant for the first couple of years, which is probably the sustainable amount of time that you could really say, I'm going to, be there, because we're open lunch and dinner for the first 6 nights, 6 days when we first opened. And then, as we got a little bit smarter, we have like the appropriate managers and sommeliers, and we kind of organically grew in that way. But yeah, picking out the wines was something that I was, even though the grape might not sound familiar at first, I really thought they were delicious. And I had this mission that I was going to talk to every table and make sure that they're enjoying their wines and, to try them. And then eventually not only the service team, but our customers were familiar enough with them, and it was just something that we did and became our own little culture that we have.
And what drew you to the marina to open A16 originally?
We looked in the places like the Excelsior, we looked in the Hayes Valley, we looked basically places that had wood burning ovens, because putting in your own wood burning oven's not really an easy feat. So that was the thing. Without those ovens, we probably wouldn't have been there, and it ended up being a great location for us. It wasn't a lot happening on the street at that time. And we got in. It was right. So it was 2004, and the restaurant before us had opened shortly after 9/11. And it was not a great time in the economy. So we got in. Things weren't on a high note. Things were pretty down. But, we really wanted to do it. So.
And what's kind of neat about that space is it goes far back in lengthways. And at the back of it, it opens up in terms of to the sky. So what you see when you walk in is that as you go further in, it gets lighter.
Yeah.
Which kind of draws you into the restaurant.
Yeah. A lot of people think that it's smaller, and it's not huge by any means, but it just is long and narrow and feels a little bit more of a city feel in that way, I guess, because it is, well, you're in a city, but it's not like a spacious restaurant where, I mean, Rockridge has a little bit more space in general, about the same amount of seats, but just a different layout.
Did it take some translation to explain to people what Neapolitan pizza was at that time?
Yes. I think that we spent a lot of time, we still spend a lot of time going over our focus for how pizza is a culture in Naples. And pizza is, you know, to get it right, it should have that bend and have that, you could taste the freshness in the dough, and just has that, it cooks really at a high heat and really fast. And sometimes you just get a marinara or margarita and that's it. But there's a lot of other types of pizzas you can get there too. You know, the quattro stagione is a classic in Naples, or different like stuffed ones. And we've been having a lot of fun. I mean, in Naples, they have a big hot dog thing because of since World War II, it was a big outpost for American GIs. And there's like pizzas that have hot dogs in the crust, but we don't do that one. But you know, we take our pizza. Our pizzas, it's not as easy as it seems. The culture in Naples is to do it right. It's just really a soulful kind of food.
And have you seen an evolution in the Marina in terms of what's happened there in the last decade or so?
Well, I think the understanding of pizza in general from what we grew up with, and, you know, everybody has their own style they like. And so, like, if you like a Roman style or Tuscan style, it's the heat of the oven's much less. So you get a crackery, thinner dough, and that's also delicious. It's just a style. And then, you know, for us, we're so integrated in the Neapolitan style, so we're looking for something that's closer to naan, or, you know, of course it came translated from the Greek colonial times, where pita, pizza, is what they think it evolved from. And then, you know, I appreciate all types of pizza, but I just, if we're going to say we're doing one type, we want to try to do it the best we can.
You kind of built the rest of the restaurant around the idea of pizza and what would go with that.
Exactly. But of course, there wasn't, also burrata was something kind of new at the market about 10 years ago. And we tasted tons of burrata, and we went with a new local producer named Joya, and we still use them. But now there's some buffalo being raised in Sonoma County, and we're buying the milk from them and making gelatos and things. So we're stretching we're playing around with it.
In a lot of ways, it feels like it's gotten easier in terms of raw ingredients, whether it be food or wine.
Yeah, there's so much more. And a lot more people have, in both areas, have started import. They're, you know, really searching out to find that Ciro or wonderful Galliopo. They're really working hard on this. And it's, you know, there's some regions that are easier than others. But now you have some importers that have multiple Etna Rossos. Great producers. And before, I can remember counting or having conversations with someone like Salva Foti or people where you're like, there was 3 Etna Rossos and now there's 50. So it's changed dramatically.
Do you think that you had a different perspective going in than a lot of sommeliers would have because you had gone to cooking school a little earlier?
You know, I just wanted to do the best of my ability. And so I was really just into it, and I was okay focusing on something that was not the norm in our area because I was there. I was there, and
you had been to Italy.
I'd been to Italy, and I loved our team and everybody. It just goes together. So that's sort of the energy in our place. It's we have 40 wines by the glass and half bottle carafe and tastes, and we have a variety of, you know, from high acid, dry, crisp whites to things that age on the lees for 9 years or something. You know, there's like all these intricate small producers, and we get to taste them and know them and learn about them. And so for us, it's a very rich lifestyle.
I mean, I think one of the things that really stands out about Italy is the diversity of what's available.
With some wineries, I mean, you look at their stories, and I mean, Italy unified in 1861 as a country, and they've been making, you know, their families have been making wine much longer. So there's some, like, Sicily compared to Alto Adige or Friuli seems drastically different. But if you look at people like Giusto Acopinti to Gravner and things that they've taken from each other and learn, I don't think it's unsimilar from how we learn from each other in our business or restaurants or gain some knowledge and understandings has a global community of how we can improve or things that might trigger that thought of, hey, yeah, our ancestors used to make wine like this. Why don't I try amphora or things like that? And I recently went on a trip to Santorini because we're working on a new Southern Italian wine book. I look at the A16 book and there's so much that I want to add to it. And so we're starting this process and we're not rushing into it. Kate and I, we worked on A16 SBQR books and now we're just focusing on this, just spending some time on regions and having a good time tasting through like the white wines of Sicily, completely not what you would have expected a decade ago. It's just, Sicily is still 2/3 white wine, but you think of it as red wine more. Of course, if you looked at Etna alone, that's 90% red, but you know, it's like a living history basically. So I feel like right now it's a super exciting moment.
What was it like writing that original book, A16 Food Plus Wine?
I was pregnant and I was traveling to Italy with Kate. I had this small little window with my first son and I remember showing up there and I guess that's not what you do when Italian women are pregnant. And there, people were just so worried. They kept calling me and trying to feed me. And I think my belly grew about 1 inch a day because I was, we had our friend Bruno Di Concilis, who lives in Salerno. He's a wonderful person and winemaker and done a lot for the southern part of Campania in terms of wine. But he could not believe that we were renting a car. And so he took a train up just to meet us at the rental car place because he did not want us to drive out of Naples, you know? And so we went to Naples, Ischia, Amalfi, drove down to Calabria, Basilicata, Puglia, and then Avellino, Taurasi in about 13 days and kept visiting wineries. And just because we had to go there and get that information, and you probably know what I'm talking about. It's like, well, I haven't been to this place. And even if I even stop in this town and get an espresso, I've been there, you know, or I stop and taste this wine because it'll take a lifetime to actually spend as much time as you really want to on, you know, unearthing facts and learning. But, you know, like this book from Ian DeGatta, The Native Grapes of Italy, brilliant, amazing. And sometimes I read what he's put in there and I go, not only does he gets it and wrote about it, but I'm not sure that's fact. You could fact check that. You know, someone told you that, and I am so glad you put this, your feelings on this grape down, because that's Italy. You just have to embrace the chaos.
What was it that made you decide to open SPQR? What was the genesis of that?
We were in the process of building a restaurant we ended up not opening called Urbino. It was going to be a Marchigiana restaurant in Dogpatch area. And it was already in construction and we had raised the capital for it and everything. And it was right before 2008. And we ended up backing out because our partners were the developers of the project. And they ended up going bankrupt, unfortunately. And then there was 2008 and we just thought we could have opened, but we conservatively didn't. But we were partially staffed for that. So we ended up finding a small spot on Fillmore Street and thinking, this seems really like Rome because it's so small. And, you know, let's do something Roman. And we called it SBQR. And at first when we opened, it was flat priced. It was fried. People still come for fried Brussels sprouts. We don't have because Matthew is now, it's evolved into a Michelin star restaurant and he's had a really exciting year. And
congratulations.
Thank you. I mean, he's a creative chef and just doing his thing, but he's now farming a lot of ingredients in Napa. And then when he came on board, we changed the wine list drastically because we were serving more things like truffles and different, different types of luxury ingredients, smoked flour and the fettuccine and, things like that. So I said, well, that's beautiful and wonderful. We need the wine to complement that. So then we really upped the ante there too. And we have a lot of fun with that. It was fun before, but now it's even evolved into something more beautiful we could have expected. So
what did you find amongst that set of wines that maybe you hadn't been finding at A16?
So we have our fictitious boundary at A16 because I love the wines of Tuscany and in the north, but I was so sure that they would overshadow the wines of southern Italy because it was less familiar, and made the decision to not add them to the wine list. And
you felt that people would just order those and not the ones that you wanted them to just give a shot to.
Exactly. And also when you're opening, and we sort of had a shoestring budget, and if you want to put the greatest hits of Barolos and things, it's going to eat up your inventory really fast. So I had to be creative, and our lists basically have come out of being creative, and you can always build. You just got to get open. We've built a lot since we opened, but
kind of like the cuisine of Cucina Povera, like the,
yeah, exactly,
the poverty cuisine of Italy in a way. Just
exactly.
Being creative with what you have.
Right. And, obviously, there's things like I always joke around where we've been able to add some really nice bottles. And then there's that point of you can't sell it if you don't have it,
Right.
So that's a good
Well,
point,
when I go into A16 now, I've never been to SPQR, but when I go into A16 in a marina, there's a lot of rich guys in there. I would think.
Oh, really?
When I look around, I'm like, that guy seems like he's wealthy to me.
See,
I usually
don't know what people do, or sometimes I don't even know their name, but I know what they drink. I was like, Falanghina, or sometimes I try to know their name, but as we've opened restaurants and there's now children in schools and things like that, it blurs the lines a lot with names, and I don't want to get it wrong. So I'm constantly reintroducing myself to people that I've met a million times.
But I've totally freaked people out by being like, 95 Tiradora d'Apollo, remember? And they're like, what? Because that's what I remember about them, is what they ordered a long time ago.
That's what happens in the service industry. Yeah, so, and then at SPQR is a blast because we serve Valdo, for instance, you would think this is kind of funny because you would think that we would serve a ton of Chianti, a ton of Barolo and Barbaresco, and we have them on the list, but we're very, very small restaurant. And what's happened is the same fun we're having with these small DOCs and what's happening in places like La Marche, like the Cremin Mort Alba or, Vernaccia Nera or something, is kind of carried over to SPQR. So we serve lots of wine from Val d'Aosta. We have Valtellina. We represent the Alta Piemonte just as much as Barolo. And even though there's a higher concentration of producers in the Barolos and Barbaresco areas and Liguria. So we have representation for grapes that kind of in the similar style of A16, where they might be lesser known, but they're delicious. They go with our food and they're not as expensive. And so you could really have a lot of fun playing with them, and it won't cost you an arm and a leg if you want to buy a special wine, which sometimes, if there's things I probably spend money more on is food and wine than anything. And I was here in New York, I was at a restaurant and saw a 2001 Chinon last night and was so excited to taste it. It was delicious. So, I'm trying to find gems like that to put on too, but we have our team working has no problem talking about Pellaverga, Timorasso, Frie Blanc, Friulano, and it's easy as much as they do about Suave or Amarone. And so hopefully that's the direction that Italian wine is becoming, where it's not just everybody has the same Pinot Grigio, and Pinot Grigio is a perfectly lovely grape and there's wonderful producers out there, but it just became this next step up from bottled water. You could just drink it and it's just, just a beverage. Just you're not really getting that complexity and minerality out of it because producers have mass produced it. And so, those have a great place too, because you should have your everyday wines and that's perfect for a retail market. But when you're really putting it with food and having fun, there's a lot more options at the same price really.
So you're still looking for individual wines, not big brand wines, but you're looking at a different part of the
smaller
Italian map.
Producer, yeah. There's a lot. There's just a lot of wine in Italy, and I liked. I actually think that a lot of times I feel and I take the importer or distributor out of it, and I feel very like connected to the winemaker and representing them. And no matter what, if like they're making a great wine, whoever's selling it, I'm going to buy that wine. And
you're saying you don't like most of the importers you work with. Is that what you're saying?
No, I
I'm
like
totally it. Yeah, totally kidding.
Let me. No,
I'll still buy it from that jerk.
How about, or not. You know, just kidding. No, I'm just kidding. So, no, I try to be fair in that way because there's a lot of wines that we're looking for that people aren't bringing to us. We have to go tell them we want this wine, and we should be an easy market for people selling them. But it doesn't mean that just because you have a Fiano that, I mean, we have our specific Fianos that if you've never had a Fiano d'Avellino, we want you to come in and have this quality of Fiano d'Avellino. And we're pretty specific about it because we really care about the grape and see the future in it. And, you know, that list keeps growing because the quality of Fiano is growing. But we're not just going to pour something just because as an afterthought, you know. And I think a lot of restaurants should think of the wine part of their business as a business because we're about 40% on wine sales. And that is a just fun part of what we do. So in that way, I feel like we're balanced. And sometimes it cannot be wine programs are thought of as like just wine. Like I just want this, but why not be a little more discerning when it's such a consumer market?
I think that's an amazing idea of building the size of your list based on the quality of what is available in the market in terms of the wines from the place.
Yeah. You know, you want just a filler wine because who's going to drink it? You know, I mean, I remember who's somebody I respect very much, but before wine became such a big thing, and they used to say, oh, they like made it seem like the customer didn't know the difference.
Oh,
just white or red or, you know,
Well, the place I actually experienced that the most is really bad Italian restaurants, whether they be in this country or in Italy. You know, that place in Venice that just gives you the carafe of white and red and they never tell you what it is and stuff. Like that kind of place.
Yeah. They just went from an experience that could be an amazing introduction to their city and their region and their wines and take a lot of pride with it. But they just look at you like a tourist and then they give you something mediocre because they're running a business and then it doesn't look good for the whole city. But if you find that right spot and you have like, you find that place that has the aged Terlanos and an asparagus menu to go with it, that usually is something difficult to pair with. I had that experience. I just randomly went to a restaurant and they had like a 12 or 15 year old white wine because white wines age incredibly well when they're made well. And it was one of those epiphany, like, oh my gosh, moments where I'm literally having asparagus tasting menu in this amazing white wine. And it just, you know, then I went to visit the winery and they purposely age their whites. And so you can have whites from the 50s, the 70s, and they taste so fresh because the acid and amazing.
What was the lead in to writing the SPQR cookbook?
So we had the other side of Italy that wasn't in the A16 book. And then Matthew, 10 Speed was awesome. That's our publisher. And they were like...
You work with Aaron?
Yes. Amazing Aaron.
Really bright guy.
Mm-hmm. Super wonderful.
And he's based on the
West
Coast.
He was the editor on the book, actually. Still, he's based in the West Coast. He's in San Francisco. He had given the go-ahead to do that book. And so we had a pretty long trip. And Matthew, we visited wineries, we picked out restaurants and did like big caravan. We had like the whole family and Matthew and Kate and who's co-author and Greg. And we just kind of, we went for a while and that was a great research trip. And then he came back and it was also wonderful because not only did he get to meet the wineries and taste the wine, but so much inspiration for his menu too. So we did the regional and then later, our photographer went and took pictures at these places we had visited. And
I think the photography in the books is usually awesome.
Thank you.
Like that picture of Bruno Di Concelis on the A16 book.
When he hopped over the fence that you're not supposed to, and he went by the, you know, the largest Greek ruins on mainland Italy and Pestum, just looking up at the sky. He's so great.
Eventually, you opened A16 Rockridge, which was a little bit more recent, and that's in the East Bay. And how did that come about?
We were looking in the South Bay or East Bay, and we always love the neighborhood of Rockridge. It's such a great vibe. It's right to North Oakland, so it's pretty close to the Berkeley boundary right there.
And there's some great Italian restaurants there, like Olivetto.
Olivetto's 2 to 3 blocks away, and
Beowulf was always good. And Zachary's Pizza, which is basically what I grew up on.
Oh my, that is so funny. I went and I picked that up sometimes for the kids, and it's the biggest slice of pizza they've ever seen.
It's bigger than my head.
It's bigger than your. I was like, here's one piece of pizza for 4 of you to share.
It's the best for kids.
Yeah. So that was kind of fun. But they are used to eating pizza with us too. So like, pizzas, you go to birthday parties, you have cheese pizza.
Did you tell them it's not really pizza? Did you bring it back? And you're like, I just want you to know this stuff thing, they call it pizza, but it's not really pizza.
It's a different type of pizza, but it's different cheeses, different. Yeah, they're pretty into food and wine for a young age. It's kind of funny.
Your kids are? Seems like it. When I see my, I feel like I know your kids because I see them on Facebook.
Exactly, because they're like, I want to open those bottles for the Chipito dinner. And I'm like, in a public place. I'm like, sure, go for it. Why is that kid opening wine? He's obviously little, but okay.
Well, I mean, in between yourself on the restaurant side and doing a lot of wine, and then your husband who's done a lot of work with cocktails and Amaro, whether it be at bars or consulting, I mean, I bet those kids have seen a few.
Yeah.
Cool beverages go across the table.
It's like you can see it in them hard, like working on things. It's really funny what they pick up.
Has being a mother affected your approach at work?
Definitely have to say yes, but in a positive way. I think it's probably been a really good thing for me to be able to take a step and ask for help, build a management team, think about the future, about opening restaurants. And you can only do that if you have a really solid team of people, because one person can't run a restaurant alone. And I knew I always wanted to be a mom. So I told my business partner we would wait, you know, a couple of years, and about 3 years or so in that.
And your business partner's a female as well.
Is a female.
So she maybe understands what that's like.
No, she said children aren't in her future, but she is like an aunt to them and adores them. And, you know, for me, restaurants are a family. I think of everyone that works with me as like a part of my family. And I do what I can for their education, for travel. And you know, obviously the boys come in the restaurant and they understand that either Greg or I are usually working, and sometimes there's a sitter, or sometimes there's one of us. Every once in a while, there's both of us home, you know? So I think it feels like it has been, you know, a juggle, but they seem healthy and, you know, pretty adjusted.
So take me on a little bit of a tour of Italy.
Okay.
Tell me about some of the beverages you associate with different regions. Umbria.
That was one of my first epiphanies on food and wine, because Perugia, where Bocce, Perugina chocolates and all that is from. We were at a restaurant there, and there's truffles in Umbria, and there's also porcinis, and they're known for their lentils. And anyway, I had never tasted, but my first time tasting a Sangrentino in Montefalco was at Aldo de Capri, and I think it was just a regular Sangrentino in Montefalco. He has another one as well, and the Venticiquiani, which we know. But I had ordered umbricelli pasta with Umbrian truffles. My husband ordered the porcinis. And when his arrived, he basically was like, mine's going to be better. Mine was very simple, but his looked phenomenal. And but then pairing-wise, the truffles with the umbricelli pasta and the wine is all you needed. It was so simple. And I just had this moment of, oh my gosh, this is the best thing I've ever had. Like this, being here, eating this, drinking this, and it went fine with my husband's porcini pasta, but with the umbricelli truffles and that, it was just so memorable. It sort of started changing my whole confidence in wait a minute, these wines are, this is unique to each region. There's something super special to pay attention to here. So, I mean, Montefalco areas, there's only about 25 producers and it's very small. It's just got this really cool papal state kind of quality to it. And there's all these hilltop towns because it used to flood almost every year down in that area because of the Alps, when the Alps would melt. And so there's just this, I mean, Gian Piero Bea from Palo Bea is one of my favorite winemakers of all time. And a lot of that is his wines, but it's also him as a person and why he makes the wines he does, why he goes down to Spoletino Valley and knocks on people's doors that have these 120-year-old trees of Trebbiano to Spoletino and says, please don't chop it down for firewood. Let me contract these grapes. And painstakingly, it doesn't make any sense as a business. But
the vines go up the trees.
They go up the trees and they're 20 feet up and they're old. And he makes a beautiful Trebbiano to Spoletino in a natural way. And you go see that once and you feel like there's this tall grass and there's these ancient trees and you're like in the gorillas of the mist for vines and grapes. You're like, what? I mean, it's like Etruscan. It's still happening. There's parts of Italy where things just are just the way they're just there, and super cool.
What about Molise?
Molise Campobasso is the base camp, and that's where my in-laws are from. They emigrated here from that region, and I forget the exact year, but. Yeah, my mother-in-law's from South Philly, and so we've gone to visit it, and it's completely underrated. There needs to be more wines from there, and the Gentilia grape, you don't even see it out here, but it's amazing, and there will be a couple producers that come over, and there's a couple wines like Borgo de Colorado and De Mayo Norante, but it's like a place where they have all these mountains and it feels like you're part of like Lord of the Rings or something because these bridges connect all the mountains and you're just going from basically like mountaintop to mountaintop and you just wonder how people really worked this land before there was cars. And this is where the church bells are made and where it's like they did a lot of armor for battle and things like that because it's where they forge a lot of metal from.
So it really is like Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, it's like Lord of the Rings. It is like Lord of the Rings. And there's like lace, this like these doilies. And
they try to give you this culture. Ring and they're like, it's going to rule yeah. them all. And you're like, no, I don't want the ring.
My ears got real pointy. I'm just kidding. I wish.
What about the Campania?
You know, it's so funny because you would think, okay, for me, I have this fascination with Ischia. It has a wine training island and the Ischia Bianco was, so Vernaccia di San Gimignano from Tuscany was the first white DOC. And that was the same year, 1963, I believe, in January. And then in March, it was Ischia Bianco. And this is a time where it was really poor in Campania. I mean, this is stories about people wearing like tires for shoes. And, you know, it was after World War II, it was really devastating. But there were still grapes. And I recently was in Ischia, and there's these ancient wineries that are built into the volcano. It's very white soil. And they have like this place where there's a draft that comes into the volcano. And they have these rooms set up like in Sicily where there's palmettos. And in Ischia, they have this thing where it's called a Pietra Torcia. So it's like a big wooden screw. And they have these like massive lava stones and they screw after you've stomped on the grapes with your feet, they screw down this rock, like push it around, and so that it presses the grapes at the very end. It's just the most amazing thing. And there's a winery called Pietra Torcia from Ischia that's great as well. But I had things recently, I was there and so all these kind of abandoned wine caves or wineries that were built into the rocks, and they go back to like when the Odyssey was being written, and they have all these crazy stories, and I love that about wine. But Biancolella is just an incredible grape. But I was there, and I had this something I hadn't had. It was this yellow tomatoes, and they had aged them for a year. They were from last year's harvest, so a year old tomato that they had been hanging in their drafty volcano cellar, and they served it with salumi and things, and I was just like, because, you know, mold's not going to grow there, apparently. And I just cut into it and ate this year-old tomato, no problem. It's just normal. And they had these great stories, like maybe tomatoes were originally yellow because of the name Pomodoro. And, you know, it's like all these things that you just can learn from being there. That's just so cool.
So,
yeah.
Pomodoro, but, like Oro being gold.
Exactly. So, because you have the Caserta, the northern Campania area, and, you know, Rocca Muffino with places like Gallardi, Terra Lavoro, and grapes like Pellegrino, Casa Vecchia, and, you know, the whole phenomenon of Esprino di Aversa and the high trees. And then, you know, it's not even touching into Greco Tufo with this bright yellow sulfuric volcanic soil that, you know, I was going to bring home some in my suitcase after I've been in Italy, but it would have smelled too bad, so I didn't take it. Can you imagine? There's like sulfur rock in my suitcase because it was so cool. And he was,
you're like, you know, the Madame Curie, yeah, like bringing around the radioactive stones, you know.
Like, it's the power.
Hey,
the
look
power
at this. It's like kryptonite.
It's a...
Don't touch. Ow!
There's just so much. I mean, it's so rural in the Irpinia area. Taurasi is a Gothic town. And, you know, the little vineyards around the Fiano d'Avellino and Greco Tufo areas are just... They're completely forested. And it's cool climate. And, I mean, when I was there in May, there was all these pine nut trees. And, you know, they have... They're known for their bees and their Torrone and things. And it was really cold, super cold. And it snows there as well. And so I saw this wind come in, like the pine nuts on it. You saw this, like, I thought it was a campfire because so much pollen got thrown into the air. It was just in front of you. There's that much agriculture everywhere. I've never had such allergies as I didn't even know. It's like a later in life thing for me, but it was just amazing. I've never seen anything like it.
And what about Basilicata?
Basilicata is amazing. It's so different. It's obviously those biblical movies that are filmed there. And
like the Gospel according to St. Matthew, that kind of thing.
Right, exactly. You have the cave dwellers that, you know, was only not that long ago that they were told you can no longer live in caves. It's not, you know, it's now a UNESCO site. And those have since, a lot of them turned into wineries. And I was recently talking to Cecilia from Grifalco, and she and I were talking about this foraging culture that they have in Basilicata because it's so sparsely populated, and they have these particular potatoes and things. And so in the dusk time, you could see all these people out in these fields, like literally like foraging their food. Because it's not like you can drive to, you know, the corner market when you're up in this kind of rustic volcano. And I mean, they obviously have food and things, but they just really live off the land a lot there. It's really cool. And paternosters, of course, and like gods there. I just can't say enough about that family. But
and what about Calabria?
Calabria has the one of the most potential in being amazing, great next wine regions of Italy. And I love the story of Ciro Marina and Galliopo. It has a grape. It's, if I was going to go to Italy and plant something, that would probably go there because there's vines that are abandoned. It's not that expensive. They did have a mafia problem that's getting cleaned up. And it's really funny because you have that story of like the grape of the Olympians, and when Greece colonized Italy, they called Calabria Enotria, and you really feel that Greek presence. And there's towns with ancient Greek tablets and, you know, the huge statues and stories of them just taking the fresh run juice and just straight to the boat through like a pipe, like terracotta pipes. And then there's, you know, it's heavily forested. I think it's a Pollino forest that's up between Basilicata and Calabria. And they have all these porcinis and, they have, you know, just a very rich culture there. Obviously the spices and from all the types of peppers and the citrus. I was there on that trip when I was pregnant, and they were, had cases of blood oranges for €6, a whole case, you know? And so picked one of those up and just like eating those the whole time. We're driving around Italy, eating blood oranges for nothing. And it's Galliopo is a grape that it's medium bodied, beautiful, maritime, versatile. There's a winery called Avita that's was imported, and the importer didn't really think it was showing that great, sent it back. And now it got picked up again, the same vintage with a different importer. And it's like an amazing Galliopo. And so outside of LeBrandy, there's maybe a handful of producers that are doing something incredible, but there's just a lot that can still happen there. Like, it's funny, there's a lot of, I haven't even really spent any time in New Jersey, but there's a lot of like kind of like new money that went in there, and like all of a sudden you'd be like, where are we, in Italy? Because this huge McMansion house just like popped up, and there's like, you're in this little fishing village. Like, why on earth would you build some like something so gaudy here, you know? And so there's just like there's kind of this, that kind of strange culture. But then, you know, Calabria has more beaches than 10 times the Italian Riviera, so you feel like you're really isolated unless you're coming over from Sicily and taking the ferry and driving through. There's like a lot of trucks and things that go through Calabria, but, and there's a lot of Europeans that go and a vacation there, but it's really not that traveled.
What about the Manduria area? Manduria, maybe I'm saying it wrong.
You mean in Puglia?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny, being a California native, I went to visit my friend Paolo Contale, who lives out, I mean, Lecce is one of the most beautiful cities. It's just unbelievable. And I went to go visit him, and thinking that Primitivo would be a main grape of the area, but it turns out it's just from this little, like, Primitivo de Manduria and Salice Salento and Gioia di Colle and some places like that where Primitivo grows, but it's like 90% Negro Amaro in Puglia. So I had a real awakening going, oh, Negro Amaro, because it's not usually listed on the bottle. Some bottles it is, but you really, that's a tough thing with Italian labels, is if it's from this area, it's going to be this, usually this grape. And more producers are putting the grape on the labels, but it's just their wine. It's their regional wine, and that's just what they drink. So Puglia is tough because a lot of bulk wine that was made and produced, and there's even some places outside of, in more northern, but where there was like a train that went straight to Bordeaux. I don't know if you saw, like, outside of Trani, there was a, you know, it was owned by like some French houses, or, you know, just, it's been notorious for being blended in with more northern European wines that couldn't ripen. So there's this bounty there, and the potential Sicily, the southern Italy is just, it's, there's so much wine, and the more people focusing on quality. There's a producer from Gioia di Colle that's Guttarolo, and they're doing some exciting new wines. But that area, I think, is special for Primitivo myself. But
why so?
It's less extracted. It's more of that black olive fig. You eat a lot of seafood in Puglia, and you have tons of vegetables. So you don't want, and it's hot. So usually when it's really hot, you don't want that 16% red wine. And Puglia, unlike Campania and Sicily, is mostly red wine. And so they make beautiful rosatos out of their Negro Amaro. But the Gioia di Colle, it just seems like a tiny bit cooler climate. And they have really, their Primitivos have nice acidity, lower tannins, and just seem really food friendly. And I found those to be some of my favorites.
And going down to Sicily.
Paradise, Sicily. I'm like, oh boy, I just can't say enough about Sicily. From the few producers that are outside of Messina and Faro, I think Vittoria and Siracusa, that area is probably one of the most exciting regions outside of Etna on Sicily. And I love, you know, of course, Novella Mascalese, but when you get a really good Nera d'Avola, it's amazing. And I think in that area outside of Pechino, and so if you're going towards Agrigento, and there's a lot of Nera d'Avola all over the island, but when you get it to that, it's like a chocolate-covered cherry, nice depth of fruit, but not too big. And the Sicilians think that, I've heard from producers that it should have like almost like something that could go with sardines, because they eat a lot of seafood in this part of the island. But yeah, I in the white wines of Sicily, I've just been focusing on those a lot in the past month, because they used to be kind of on the tropical side, and outside of Benanti Pietramarina, there wasn't as much going on. And now you could find really exciting whites, and they like what the Bartolis are doing, the the grape Zabibo is super fun, and some people are doing some natural Zabibos, and Caracante is exciting, and you know, it's just that there's just, you're going to see a lot more wine, and the quality and value is also really high.
So take me back to Sardinia.
Yes, back to, I fell in love with Vermentino. It was one of the first, I think that was the reason why we went to Sardinia for the first time, because it was just such an eye-opening, beautiful wine and story. And going to the Spanish towns like Alghero and having Canulari from that area, where it tastes almost, it's lighter than a Pinot Noir. The reds from the West Coast tend to be on the lighter side because they have that exposure to all that cooler climate. And the Southeast corner is much richer, the Carignano de Solsis and the Cotinaus from, say, the Torriga from Argiolas, or the Terrabruno from Santati. And those are beautiful wines. And I have a dish, there's a dish that Matthew has at SPQR, has a burnt orange sauce, and it's a chestnut filled pasta. And it has like a rapini, broccoli rapini, and those bitters and sweet things with that wine. It's just like, and the earthiness of the chestnut is like one of my all time favorite pairings. So,
Shelley Lindgren, she's an ambassador for the Southern Italian wines at A16. SPQR and A16 Rockridge. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Shelley Lindgren sharing with you what she likes so much about Italy. 750 is an easy platform for discovering everything you need to find as a wholesale buyer of wine and spirits. The searches are easy to do, and they provide a wealth of information for you to determine exactly what you need to buy today. Pricing, size, characteristics, who the distributor is, the contact information, and even helpful features like easy startup of credit apps are all available for you, as well as a listing of tastings, which is something I refer to almost all the time to find out about the tastings in my neighborhood. I personally use the 750 service. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's extraordinarily helpful if you are a buyer of wine and spirits at the wholesale level. And I recommend that you waste no time in making it a part of your daily routine. 750.com, the 750 service, make it work for you.
That was our show.
If you're curious about what we're up to in the future, check us out on Facebook. Give us a like and you'll see all our fancy, fancy posts. It's I'll Drink to That, Talking Wine with Levy Dalton is a Facebook fan page. Hey, fan page. Yeah. We're on Twitter at Drink to That Pod. And we're also up on Instagram, some pretty artistic shots sometimes, sometimes not, sometimes good though, at Levy Opens Wine. And then I got to tell you, we're also got our own website there. It's alldrinktothatpod.com, where you can stream stuff off of it or download direct episodes so you don't have to go through iTunes if you don't want to. We like to give options. We're about options here. So lots to do, lots to think about. Maybe you want a t-shirt. Maybe you like a fancy, fancy, well, they're not that fancy, but they're pretty cool. I'll Drink to That t-shirt of your very own in a variety of different colors, shapes, sizes, onesies even. I mean, you can get onesies, you can get tanks, you can get biker tanks, you can get tees, you can get other stuff, hoodies, for God's sakes. It's all up there. You can find the information up on our website if you'd like to check it out and wear what you hear. And then there's also that possibility you could shoot us some real support. Shoot us a little dough. Help keep the microphones rolling. We are here because of dedication, because of love, because of interest. But we're also here because we make the finances work, and we could always use a little help with that. Thanks for your consideration. When did A16 Tokyo open up?
That opened 5 years ago, and we've had this great cultural exchange where for instance, our pastry chef was there in October teaching them some of the recipes, and it's just been a really positive experience. So we get to go, and they also kind of spend time back and forth, and they love their French food too. So, and they have this cake time in the afternoon. So kind of like high tea, but they eat these like huge pieces of beautiful cakes. And
I knew I was missing something in my life.
You're open for dessert in the afternoon.
It's cake time. I've always needed this.
It's cake time. I know. It's like about, you know, post between lunch and dinner. It's everybody goes out for dessert and tea. Just, I think it's what you do.